We're going to turn back tonight to the book of Psalms. You don't need to really turn to Psalms, but in your workbook, I've got a little tiny bit I want to add to what's in your book about Psalms, and then we're going to turn to the book called Proverbs. So I think this is probably page 134, right at the end. And we talked about different themes you find in the songbook for the nation of Israel, which is the book of Psalms. And these are basically poems that are set to music. The Israelites, as they met together, you know, they would sing these just like we grab a hymnal and sing out of a hymnal, or we can flash words up on a screen and sing along with music. But this was their way of singing in worship. So Psalms is a worship book, a hymn book, basically. And I gave you, as we finished last week, these six themes that are dominant in the songbook of Israel. And right at the very end, and if you want, maybe in the bottom section on the page, you can, if you want to add some of this, you can. But about three statements I want to give you as we finish up talking about Psalms. And it's not in your book, but I think it's some good applications. Number one, when you turn to the book of Psalms, it might surprise you to discover that you don't have to turn to a prophet like Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Jonah. You don't have to turn to a prophet of the Old Testament to find reference to Christ, the coming Messiah. Even in the book of Psalms, you will find... Hey, I'm going to use your board, Larry. Here we go. Even in the book of Psalms, you will find some psalms that were written in kind of a prophetic purpose, and they are called messianic psalms. There we go. Look how well that board works. Oh, see that? I know that thing made Larry give out a holy grunt just now. So, if you have a psalm whose primary purpose is to speak of the coming Messiah, then it's called a messianic psalm. Now, there are several that throughout the book of Psalms you'll find reference. And what happens is a lot of times in these psalms, they will have a line in it will be something that Jesus repeated in his ministry. And it might surprise you the number of times Jesus quoted the book of Psalms in his ministry. And so I'm going to give you one. I lied. I forgot. We are going to turn to a psalm. Let me give you the most, I'm going to say most, I guess famous, messianic psalm in the hymn book, and that's number 22. So turn to that, and let me show you how this looks and how it works. Psalm 22. If your Bible may even have it listed that way, but if not, this is widely recognized as a psalm that pretty clearly shows that Jesus, when he arrives in the first century, would be the Messiah. If you look in the first verse, you'll find an example of a statement that Jesus quoted during his ministry. So the very first verse of Psalm 22, messianic psalm, David's writing this psalm, and basically David cries out in distress and says, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Now, that is something that Jesus proclaims from the cross as he is dying. So he quotes this psalm. But don't forget the context of it. The context is David himself, and he is in a great time of struggle and difficulty in his life. Now, how bad was it? How bad was it? It was this bad. It was so bad in David's life, he cried out in prayer, "God, you've left me." Well, that's pretty bad. Now, don't get too spiritual on me, because if you will be honest, you probably have made a very similar statement in your life as well when you've gone through a horribly difficult time. I mean, I kind of have, right? Where we kind of cry out the same way. All right, Lord, where are you? Right? I mean, this person I met with today for a couple hours, it's like, listen, I'm praying and I'm waiting. I'm trying not to get my hands involved, but like, I need God to answer. All right. So David even gets there. And I mean, this is right now. Remember, David, a man after God's own heart. I mean, they're pretty tight. And David says, Lord, it's so bad right now, I feel like you've forsaken me and you've left me. Now Jesus takes it on a cross and applies it there in a prophetic sense to when he's bearing our sin, substitutionary atonement, bears our sin. And I don't understand how it happens, but it's so bad when Jesus becomes our sin that it appears that the Father turns his back on his Son as he takes the brunt of wrath towards sin and pays a debt for us. And so when Jesus experiences that in his humanity, he cries out in prayer, my God, why have you forsaken me? And he's quoting from Psalm 22, Messianic Psalm. But it gets better. Okay? So then as you work your way through this example of a Messianic Psalm, then when you get down to verse 6 through 8, here's David. Okay, this is not the words of Jesus, this is David. But it applies to the Messiah later. And David basically says about himself, because he acknowledges God's holiness and all that, so he says about himself, man, I am just a worm and not even a man. I'm not even worth taking up space on the earth. Job felt that way too, once God responded to the horrible time he went through. But here's what he adds. I am a reproach of men and despised by the people. All who see me, they sneer at me. They separate or mock with the lip. They wag their heads saying, commit yourself to the Lord. Let him deliver him. Let him rescue him because he delights in him. Wasn't that funny? When Jesus was on the cross, he quoted Psalm 22. He didn't only quote, my God, why have you forsaken me? He even quoted David's words in anguish here, where people are sneering at him and ridiculing him and saying, oh, he's so righteous and holy. Let God take care of him. We don't care about him. And that's the exact same thing they did when Christ was on the cross, wagging their tongues at him in ridicule. Well, it gets better. Then you get down to verse 13. David continues explaining how difficult things are in life. Everybody's against him. God, you've forsaken me. And he gets to verse 13. And he starts to describe what the people are saying about him. He says, these people, they open wide their mouth at me, just like a ravening and roaring lion. And David says, when this happened, I'm poured out like water. My bones are all out of joint. My heart is like wax. It is melted within me. My strength is dried up like a potsherd. And my tongue cleaves to my jaws and like the starvation and thirst. And you lay me in the dust of death. I'm headed to the grave. I'm dying right now. Dogs have surrounded me. A band of evildoers has encompassed me. Watch this. David says they pierced my hands and my feet. In fact, I'm so emaciated, I can count all of my bones. The people look and they stare at me. And then what they do, David says, they also then take off my garments and they divide my garments among them. And for my clothing, they start casting lots and playing games to see who's going to get my coat. Whoa. This is in the hymn book and it's prophesying down the road. And Jesus would experience a lot of what David writes about in this psalm. Now, here's where the real... I'm going to do it again, Larry, so I can say I use it a second time. Here's what you need to recall with this. And I know I went through this psalm and went through some of them. Guess how many years this psalm is written before Jesus comes on the scene? About 1,000 years. And David goes through a very difficult time. God, you have forsaken me. People are ridiculing me. They're sneering at me. And David even says later in that part I just read, the attack is so severe, it's like they're piercing my hands and my feet. Now, here's what's interesting about this. My understanding is the process of piercing the hands and feet in crucifixion was really not even invented yet. It would not even be administered that way until you get closer to the Roman Empire here, first century. And yet Psalm 22, as David writes, Holy Spirit guiding him, right? As David writes, he makes statements that apply directly to the coming Messiah, and yet nobody had a clue when he was writing it. Isn't that something? Nobody had a clue. Like, David, what are you talking about, pierce the hands and feet? We're confused. You know, you're so thirsted or thirsty that your tongue is sticking to your mouth and you're, you know, you can count bones and you're weakened and beaten. What are you talking about, David? We never seen anything like this. And then we get to the first century. It's like, oh my goodness. Jesus starts quoting this psalm from the cross. And he experiences what David writes. So the point is, some of the psalms, and many of those, you're going to find references to the Messiah. And this is one very clearly done that way. So that's the first statement as we wrap up the book of Psalms. Second statement is, in case you ever get discouraged in life. Now you may not, but in case you... Okay, Delma says he has once or twice.
Amen.
Okay, even an amen to it. In case you do get discouraged in life, let me prescribe some medicine. It might surprise you again that the Psalms have quite a therapeutic value when you're hurting in life and you're suffering in life, because what happens is in the Psalms you find a lot of raw emotion. There's things in some of the Psalms you're like, you shouldn't say that to God. But we're human, right? And we've got this raw emotion. So what you'll find, the reason the Psalms have brought so much encouragement and comfort to people through the ages is they are a great source of encouragement and comfort when life is not very good. So let me give you a kind of just a quick question and see what you think. Context of a funeral. All right, which psalm do we fall on very, very often in the context of a funeral? 23rd Psalm. And is it like I shared it last week in Mrs. Hall's service? I think it's verse 4, and that's the verse, right? That's the one where, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil. Okay, how many times you think... Now remember, this is a poem to be set to music for people to use in worship. That's their hymn book. How many times do you think that a dying saint has been there in the bed when a chaplain, a family member, a pastor, someone sits there and reads to them that reminder for comfort that although you're walking through the valley of the shadow of death right now, fear no evil. Fear no evil. So the point is, there are psalms that you need to bookmark and go back to those in times of discouragement and hardship. And the last final point here, that just a little application, is don't ever be ashamed of reading and praying through and meditating on and memorizing your hymn book. Okay, now I'm talking about the book of Psalms here. In fact, we've got hymns in our hymn book that are ingrained in us as people of faith. And I know we sometimes joke about, well, it used to be some of the songs of victory in Jesus, like the, you know, the Baptist National Anthem, you know, or Amazing Grace kind of holds that title. So your Old Testament hymn book, Psalms, has the same value. And you might discover a lot of help there. Literally praying, you know, you find that psalm that speaks to your situation, and you pray through that psalm and reflect on that as you're like asking God for intervention and help, and it just might be a great help. So those are my final thoughts on the hymn book for Israel, in addition to what we looked at in your workbook. All right, anything stand out or testimony, your favorite psalm, you want to write a new psalm? All right. Let's turn the corner then to the next book on the route. That is the book of Psalms. It is a poetic book as well as Job. And there are three other books of poetry that we're going to give a brief overview of. And the next one is this book called Proverbs. On page 137, as we begin looking at the book of Proverbs, they define this, I guess, lesson or chapter as a bit of wisdom. And so the first question to answer is, what in the world is a proverb? So let's put something down in that box. You can add to this if you want, but here's what I've discovered. I like things simple. I like things simple and plain that I can hopefully remember and apply. So if you were to open Merriam-Webster's dictionary, any dictionary, they would define a proverb basically as a short, wise saying. That's it. Okay, so your grandfather, your grandmother, your parents, somebody you know, they may have a statement they're very fond of saying in their life, and there's so much truth in it and wisdom in it, you could call it a proverb. All right, so in your Bible, you have a book, I think there's 31 chapters that mankind has divided it into, but you have a book that is full of nothing but short, wise sayings. That's all it is. Series of short, wise sayings. Now, if you look at the very first verse of the book, it gives you some hint as to who is writing the majority of these wise sayings. So it starts off and says, "These are the short, wise sayings of Solomon, who was the son of David, the king of Israel." Now remember when we did our starting our kingdoms, we had first king was Saul, and Saul wasn't exactly all that great. And then God sought after a man after his own heart, that was David. After David was his son Solomon. It's now Solomon who is writing the bulk of these proverbs, and also the next two books we're going to look at. So the first verse tells us that these are wise sayings written by Solomon. Now what's interesting about this, I think this is kind of neat. There's so much, oh my goodness, there's so much wisdom in one generation passing down these short wise sayings to the next generation. Some of you are alive today because your mom and daddy, grandfather, grandmother passed on something to you that kept you out of trouble or gave you some wisdom in life or whatever it may be. There's so much value in that, in having, having that preceding generation passing on wisdom. So what Solomon does, when you look down to verse 8, after he introduces the book as far as wisdom and wise sayings, in verse 8, then he says, "I want you to hear or listen, my son, to your father's instruction, and do not forsake your mother's teaching." Oh my goodness, the value of parents. Isn't that something? I'm thinking about Mrs. Eller, right?
Yes.
HP. It's HP, right? That's what he... Okay. I'm thinking of Eller. I'm going to tell you what, y'all. Hey, this is going to step aside. I can't help it. So we was last week at Sally Hall service, and I told somebody, it might have been her daughter, I said, I am so thankful that God allowed me to be here at Mountain View with a good, solid church. I don't think anybody hates me. I don't hate anybody. We get along. I said, I'm so thankful for that. But I said, let me tell you, the only downside, you ready? The only downside to being in a wonderful place of ministry for a while is you get to know these people and they become like family, and they get sick and they die. And it hurts. I said, that's the downside for me. The value of parents, right? So Solomon says, now listen, boy, okay, listen to what I'm teaching you. Listen to what your mom has taught you. These are sayings to guide you in life. That's what the book of Proverbs is. So let's look in that chart. Your book gives here five divisions in the collection of sayings. So we can start putting these down. All right, the first nine chapters in our collection of wise sayings could be summarized by the phrase, the value of wisdom. And I guess it would be a good idea. I don't think your book does it, so let's do this. Let's try to define something. If the book of Proverbs is a list of short, wise sayings to guide you in life, then it might help to try to define what wisdom is. Because this is the kind of word where it's easier felt than telt, right? You know it, but it's hard to really define it as a kind of an abstract term. So here's what I've found that helps me, and you may have some other ways of thinking about it that will help all of us, but this is what helps me. I look at it as knowledge is the accumulation of facts. Okay, I can pick up an encyclopedia. Well, there was a time we used encyclopedias. When I was small, I remember the little salesperson would come by, World Book Encyclopedia. They were brown World Book Encyclopedias, and Mom and Daddy bought the set. And I remember using them things for, like, you know, papers and things in school. So there was a time we had these things called encyclopedias. Now you go online and find all the encyclopedic information you want, and you hope some of it's true, right? You hope some of it's true. But anyway, so I can pick up a dictionary, I can pick up an encyclopedia, I can pick up a repair manual for a vehicle, and I can get a bunch of facts, right? I can increase in knowledge. I can pick up a medical manual. I can talk to Ben and Catherine, pick up some medical information. I can get some facts, okay? But here's where to me, it's a different thing. So having the facts is one thing, but knowing how to apply the facts is another thing. Okay, that other thing is wisdom. So this really sounds weird. The most intelligent person you know can also be the greatest fool, right? Because you can accumulate knowledge and facts and data, but if you don't know how to rightly apply those, the opposite of wisdom is foolishness. So the way I think about it, if these are sayings for wisdom, the value of wisdom, basically it means for me, you can go to school and get piles of knowledge, all kinds of subject areas. But wisdom means I can take the knowledge I have and apply it in the right way so I can make something of my knowledge, make something of my life. I can live right. Okay, that's wisdom. So Solomon says, boy, talking to his son, listen to what I'm telling you. Listen to what your mom is telling you. It'll make you wise instead of a fool. So take the knowledge you've got and learn how to use it. The first 9 chapters of the book of Proverbs speaks about the value of wisdom. And if you don't want to be a fool. Now, if you look in chapter 10, all of a sudden, there's a little bit of a different intro to this set of Proverbs. And verse 1 in chapter 10 says, all right, now we've talked about the value of wisdom. Now, these are the Proverbs of Solomon. So now it goes into some specific statements. So from chapter 10 to about chapter 24, it is a large collection of short, wise sayings. Now, the whole book is, but he kind of sets the stage with wisdom, and now it gives you some wise sayings. And I'm going to point this out later or next week, but I will also say the book of Proverbs is not categorized. So it's not like Solomon puts all the nuggets of truth about anger in one place and greed in one place. It's just all mixed up in there. Bunch of short sayings of wisdom. And then when you turn to chapter 25, you find another heading in the book. And while it is still wise sayings of Solomon, it says in the first verse of chapter 25 that now following are Proverbs of Solomon, but they are Proverbs which the men of Hezekiah, king of Judah, transcribed. Hezekiah was another king of Judah, was a good king, and I don't know if he found a collection of Solomon's Proverbs, how it came about. But now Hezekiah says, all right, now, y'all write these out and add them to this book of wisdom and Proverbs. That's chapter 25 to chapter 29. Then at the very end of the book of Proverbs, we've got a couple individuals mentioned. In chapter 30, it says, now in this section, these are the words of Agur, who is a son of Jacob, and he gives a burden or an oracle. Now, sort of kind of the bad news here is we don't have a clue who Agur is. All we know is he too is a man who provided these wise sayings. Now, some people think that even there, it may be that Solomon was referenced himself, maybe a nickname he had. We don't know. We don't know who Agur is. But in chapter 30, you find that heading that these now are the words or proverbs of Agur. And then there's one more that would also make a great Bible trivia question. In chapter 31, right at the end, now we have the words of a king named Lemuel, the oracle or burden which his mother taught him. Now, same thing. Who is King Lemuel? Nobody knows. Some think it could have been a nickname for Solomon, maybe a nickname his mama gave to him. And since he was king, this last section kind of focuses on a virtuous woman. So maybe she used, or he used a nickname there as the king of Lemuel. We don't know. But in chapter 31, you've got these specific words from this one named King. Now, I'll also tell you, in case you were interested, for our ladies in here, Proverbs chapter 31 is this is probably one of the most beautiful chapters in all the Bible that describes a virtuous woman or an excellent wife. So when you get down to verse 10, Lemuel says that an excellent wife, who can find, her worth is far above jewels. And it goes describing this worthy woman. And then at the very end, you've got that famous verse, verse 30, that charm is deceitful and beauty is vain. But if you can just find a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised. Okay, so chapter 31. That's the Proverbs 31 blueprint for a virtuous woman. And it comes from the pen of King Lemuel. So those are categories or divisions in this series of wise sayings, kind of by like author in the different sections. All right, anything there before we move on? In fact, I read a part of Proverbs 31 last week at Sally Hall's service. I've used it quite a number of times. In fact, I think at Marion's service, I think I remember referencing Proverbs 31. So it's a really pretty passage for virtuous, excellent wife, virtuous woman. Look under the chart, the key to wisdom makes it very clear that wisdom is the main subject of Proverbs. Solomon answers questions such as, how do I get wisdom? How can I keep it? What do I do with it? So, let me remind you. What did, when Solomon was given the opportunity to ask God for anything, do you remember what Solomon asked for?
Wisdom.
He asked for wisdom, for a discerning heart. And guess who it is that ends up writing the book of Proverbs for the most part? It's Solomon. Isn't that something how it works? Isn't it something how if God equips you for something, He's probably calling you to something, right? And so Solomon says, out of all the things I could ask for, riches and long life, I want wisdom, a discerning heart. And now we're the beneficiaries of some of his wisdom in this book. Now, if you are in chapter 31, I apologize. I'm going to give you whiplash. Look at back to chapter 1 and verse 7, and this is going to give you a definition of knowledge, the beginning of knowledge, and this is a key verse in the book. When you look at the book of Proverbs and try to understand where knowledge, wisdom come from, chapter 1, verse 7, and this is not the only time it's in the book, it's repeated throughout the book. But the answer to the question of the origin of knowledge, wisdom, is in this verse where Solomon writes, "It is the fear of the Lord that is the beginning of knowledge." The opposite of wisdom is the foolish. So fools are the ones who despise wisdom and instruction. Now, here's the answer to the question at the bottom. According to this verse, the very first step on the road to wisdom is what? To fear the Lord. So that tells me that no matter how many classes I take at the community college, at the college, at the university, at the master's level, at the doctoral level, no matter how much knowledge I attain, I am not going to start off on the right foot down the path of wisdom if I don't start with fearing the God who made me. Now, here's the problem. A lot of people gain a lot of knowledge, and sometimes they learn how to apply that knowledge, but I would argue it's all for naught if you leave God out of it. That's what Solomon says. So the very beginning of wisdom and knowledge is a fear of the Lord. So then the question becomes, I think it's on the next page at the top there, then what does that mean to fear the Lord? Now, in one aspect, I do think, we word it this way, that fearing God means respecting Him or reverence for Him. And man, that's so right. It's holding Him in very high regard, exalting Him, no one above Him, no one like Him. And I've got such a reverence and fear of Him in that sense that I just put Him first, okay? But don't completely leave out the basic definition of fear. No, I don't need to be afraid of God. He's a good, good Father. He loves me. But I also have learned in my life that just as parents can instill fear, right? I think I told y'all before, I don't know why, but Daddy had a black belt about yay wide, and I know it fit around his waist. But for some reason, instead of keeping it in the dresser drawer in the bedroom, they kept it in the kitchen drawer for easy access. But the reason is it had been broken, so he couldn't use it anyway. So Mom would figure, wow, what a great weapon. I mean, what a great disciplinary tool. Sorry, I didn't use that.
Well, right?
Didn't even let it slip. She sure did, Greg. So what I'm trying to say is, yeah, I mean, there is an element of fear, right? This figure of authority. And my mama gets mad and fire starts coming out of her nostrils. And her feet pick up speed as she's headed down the hall to my room. There's some fear. Right? I mean, there is some fear. Now, I'm not afraid she's going to kill me. Not all the way, but there's some fear. Okay, so there's a real fear, right, of getting in trouble and punishment and all that. But the thing is, even when the parent does that, it's not, okay, if it is truly for punishment and inflicting, like, you know, mortal danger, then they're going to jail, and they ought to. But if the purpose of it is to correct and discipline, that's a whole different thing. So it instilled fear, right? Because I don't want to get, you know, I don't want to, but it also instilled a respect and reverence, right? Okay, so yes, to fear God means respecting Him, revering Him, but don't completely leave out that other aspect. He's a holy God, and my Bible says it is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God, right? My Bible says my God is a consuming fire. So you can take your chance with Him if you are in wickedness, but you got it coming, right? So when we talk about fear in the Lord, I know it's not just that negative part with the punishment. I understand that it's primarily such a reverence for God and who He is and His authority. So that is the key in chapter 1, verse 7, the fear of reverence for God. In other words, every person's got, you know, what I kind of call that God-shaped void in the soul, in the heart. And you can try to fill it with a bunch of other stuff. And just excuse my English, but it ain't going to work. I like the word ain't, by the way. But it's not. It's not going to work. And there's so many people around you where you work, they can't understand why life doesn't make sense and why can't I find this peace and that purpose and whatever else and something's not right. It's not going to make sense. It all starts with a reverence for the God who made you. That's where it starts. So Solomon says, if you want wisdom, if you're trying to gain knowledge and apply it rightly in your life, it's got to start with your walk with God. I like the way he starts that in chapter 1, verse 7.